everyone, and welcome back to Unyielded, Thriving No Matter What. I'm your host, Bobby Kaler, and I'm so happy that you've joined us. Our mission is to provide stories and resources that will give you inspiration to explore all of the possibilities that your life can be. The possibilities are limitless, and guess what? So are you. It begins with believing. Believing in yourself, believing that the future is yours to write, believing that you can not only write your desired future, but that you have everything that you need to write it, edit it as needed, and fully and wonderfully live it. And you don't have to wait. You can start today. The pen truly is in your hand. I cannot wait to share this week's conversation with you. Before introducing this week's guest, just want to give you a quick reminder that we've launched a new segment of the Unyielded podcast. The new segment is called Rise and Thrive. They come out on Mondays, they're super short, and they are intended to be fuel for you, your week, and your life. So please check them out, and I truly hope that they add value to your week and to your life. My guest today believes that everyone is built for purpose, desires meaningfulness, and deserves dignity in work, school, and life. He is an author, keynote speaker, consultant, and researcher specializing in purposeful leadership, meaningful work, mattering, and positive organizational development. He wrote The Invisible Leader, Transform Your Life, Work, and Organization with the Power of Authentic Purpose, to provide individuals and organizations with the tools to activate purpose and create cultures where everyone matters. It was praised by Arianna Huffington as a compelling book filled with powerful stories, cutting-edge research, and practical tools that show us how to lead with purpose. He writes regularly on his blog and newsletter, The Spark, and he has been featured in media outlets such as Forbes, The Denver Post, Psychology Today, The Huffington Post, and Thrive Global. I think that you will find his passion and enthusiasm infectious. His name is Zach Mercurio, and I cannot wait for you to meet him. Zach, thank you so much for joining me.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Hey, I've been looking forward to this interview. I thought we'd kick it off. Do you want to tell the listeners a little bit about you and the work that you do?
Yeah, my work really centers around helping people create meaningfulness in their lives and in their work. So I have three lives, one of which is being a parent. I have a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old right now. But the other couple parts of my life are I do research in the Center for Meaning and Purpose at Colorado State University. And I research what makes life and work meaningful in the Department of Psychology. And then I also do work in organizations and with leaders on how to craft both approaches to our everyday work and subsequently life, and craft cultures that enable people to experience high levels of meaningfulness. And when I say meaningfulness, I mean when people feel like they matter, they feel like they and what they're doing is positive and it's significant. And it's really that mission to help people realize their own significance is what I do.
Wow. Okay. So I have to ask, what made you decide to dedicate, you know, your studies and your life to this?
Yeah. Purpose is often thought of as found somewhere out there. But what I've learned over the last decade is that purpose isn't so much out there waiting to be found as it is right where you are waiting to be acknowledged. And one of the things I've learned is how to see purpose where I am. And there's a couple of key moments for me. One, I was the youngest of three brothers. I grew up in Rhode Island, Italian family. When you're the youngest, if anybody's listening and you're the youngest, you know, you get really good at either entertaining yourself and or comparing yourself to other people. And I was really good at comparing myself. I was sort of raised to search for my own significance. And to be honest, I found it in a lot of the wrong places. You know, I went after careers with money and tried to get the starting salary. And I was educated to do that. You know, I was educated for success. Here's how you get a good job.
Wow. Yeah. Right.
So my first job out of college was I was in advertising, and on the outside, everybody would have said, Zach, you've made it, you know, you're successful, but I felt completely miserable, right? I was around people who would come to work on Monday and they talk about the weekend, right? And I was like, yeah. I don't know if I can live for 2/7 of my life. The days that begin with the letter S.
Yeah.
And it was during that time, so that I met some ordinary people that were just joyful. Mm-hmm. And one of the people I met, and I wrote about it in the book, is a cab driver in Washington, D.C. And it was on lunch break, and I took an extra long lunch break because I felt kind of dead inside from my work. And I remember he was so joyful, and he talked about not just what he did, he talked about why he did it. You know, he asked me, how's it going? And I said, oh, is it almost the weekend yet? And I grumbled what I had heard. And then I asked him, well, how's it going for you? And he started talking about just how he was people's parents they don't talk to, people's friends they never talk to. He was essentially a traveling conversationalist who happened to drive cabs. And yeah. I was like, how do we learn that perspective? And so that's when I made a shift to trying to figure out how do we learn to see our contribution and to live in a contribution-centered way. And it has since morphed into doing research on this, basically to help people not end up like me. Yeah.
Does it surprise you how many people end up that way though?
No, because you know what we ultimately we reward as a society or an organization we become.
Yeah.
You know, we can't be surprised at people who are, for example, self-oriented when we reward people for self-oriented achievement. So for example, like since all of us listening have probably gotten some sort of arbitrary letter that tells us our worth in school.
Oh, yeah.
And we're taught to pursue that outcome, that arbitrary letter, right? Or get into that grad school, or if you lead a company to get that quarterly earnings report. But what they tell you, we teach people what to do as a human being, but we don't teach people what it's like to be a human being and how to be a human being. Mm. And so inevitably what happens is if you're in systems that reward people for acquiring and achieving things, it's not a surprise that people start hinging their identity on acquiring and achieving things.
That's right.
And I think that's where I was. That's why I say I was educated for success. And the problem is, I think people in the pandemic have found is that when you attach your identity on what you do or what you acquire or what you achieve, those things always are fleeting. Mm-hmm. And when those things go, or the ability to do the things that you thought define yourself go, so too goes your sense of self. And then what? And I think yeah. that's why we've seen the mass existential crisis that we've seen coming out of this last year and a half.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense because you're kind of adrift.
You're kind of adrift.
Yeah.
And it's not so much as being adrift to me as that's being your identity is hinged on something that was not stable.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So it goes. And then it's like, who am I? I always tell like parents, I've been on a couple podcasts of parents of kids on parenting and teaching. And I said, the ultimate sense of security, if you want security for someone you care about, the ultimate sense of security for them is a sense of self-worth. Because that transcends career. It transcends what you do. If you believe that you have strengths, you have gifts, and those gifts make a unique difference and you're relied on, that mattering component,
yeah,
that's the ultimate security psychologically for an individual. Everything else is liable to rapid change.
Yeah. But it's that self-worth. I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, when you said, Zach, when you said it's not waiting to be found, it's waiting to be acknowledged. That to me means, okay, it's there. How do we go about acknowledging it?
Yeah. So that's why I think there's a big difference between like having purpose and being purposeful. So for example, I know plenty of people with really well-worded why statements or purpose statements.
Oh, yeah. Because you're supposed to.
That can't tell you for the life of them what they are, right?
Right.
But it's a matter of being able to see your purpose where you are. For example, there was a great story. It's actually here in Denver. In the pandemic, there's this woman named Brittany Ray who was fired from her job as a chef and a bartender. And I was watching this interview with her on the local news station. And she said that she needed this money to pay rent, right? But she said, instead of just saying, hey, you know, what am I going to do, or panicking, which is the traditional response, she said, my purpose is to make food and feed people. Mm. I asked the question of myself, who needs me right now? And she ended up using this bottom floor of a church. And she got some of her friends who were laid off together, and they started cooking meals for people who were stuck at home. And that's what I mean by being purposeful, yeah. right? It's instead of how am I going to get through this? Purposeful people ask who needs me to get through this, right? Instead of asking what am I going to do today, or how am I going to get through today? How is what I'm going to do today going to impact other people? when we start being purposeful, here's what we start seeing. And this is why I say purpose is right where you are. We start seeing that every day has one thing in common. No matter how your day's going, it's the opportunity to contribute.
Yeah.
And purpose is contribution. It's where your unique strengths impact other people. So if I had a room in front of me right now, I would say, how many of you all have strengths? Most people would raise their hand. How many of you all impact other people? Most people will raise their hand on a daily basis. Then you have purpose. And so it's a matter of seeing it. And once you start seeing it, what I find with people is that over time it becomes crafted. You're constantly seeing how you can be useful.
Yeah. I love that. Who needs me to get through this? I made a note of that.
Yeah. I mean, I've been working with a lot of people through this pandemic, a lot of business owners, a lot of clients, myself.
Yeah.
I lost about 50% of my business on a Friday afternoon when everything shut down. And I remember I was sitting in the parking lot in my kid's daycare, looking at my phone, freaking out, trying to figure out how I was going to get these engagements back. Like, what I was going to do? And when I remember going into my three-year-old's preschool classroom, and he came up and gave me a huge hug.
Aww.
And I realized he didn't care about all my lost engagements.
No.
He cared that I was there. And I realized that I, someone who studies purpose and meaning, had hinged my identity on what I did and what I got for what I did.
Yeah.
Versus who I was being.
Yeah.
It was a very liberating concept. And I started just asking that question that chef asked is, who can I help right now?
Yeah.
And I think that's what got me through it.
I love that. Okay. This is weird.
That's all right.
Yeah, it's weird. This morning I was working on, we're putting together a video course, and I've done videos before and it's not my favorite. I haven't done it that much. Yeah. I'm much more accustomed to being live. And I'm like, and in the back of my head, I started saying it out loud. I'm like, there's someone out there that needs to hear what you have to say. Put aside your fear and be there for them. And that to me is like, it just shifted everything. It's like, okay, whatever with the camera, whatever with the lights, whatever with the makeup, doesn't matter. There's someone who needs this. Who's that person? How can I help them?
And that's a skill.
Like,
that is a skill that people can learn, that skill of the story and the personal narrative that you have in your mind. And that's why, you know, I meet a lot of people that have this disconnect, you know, they're struggling to find meaning, right, in their life or in their work. And I did a study on university janitors, none of whom said that they were born to be a janitor, all of whom said that they found meaningfulness in being a janitor. And one of the things that we find is that it seems to have, in this world, meaning seems to have less to do with what you see in your life and more to do with how you see what's in your life. So that stopped like what you did, where it's like, you know, the experience may be unpleasant, right? Of doing a video. Like
it is.
Just like for the janitors that I interviewed, the experience of cleaning a bathroom in a university dormitory on a Monday morning is unpleasant. But I had one janitor who told me, I said, how do you find meaning in your work? And she said, every time I go clean that bathroom, I say to myself, I'm cleaning this toilet so that these kids don't get sick.
So that
mentality that you had, being able to connect even a potentially unpleasant circumstance to its ultimate inevitable impact, that's a skill that people can learn to discern more meaning and purpose where they are. And then they have that skill to discern purpose and meaning wherever they want to go.
Wherever they want to go. Okay.
So it's a really good example.
Yeah. And I love that. That's
so
powerful.
That.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm doing this so that what?
Yeah. That's cool. Okay. So you mentioned the janitor. Got to ask you.
Yeah.
Wasn't Mary the name of one of the janitors at one of the colleges?
Yep.
I love that story because her meaning was so, I don't know, it was just very touching.
She was the first person I interviewed. She was part of the pilot study before the study that I was just talking about. And one of her supervisors said, you got to interview Mary. And I said, okay. And I went in and she had been at the university for years, decades, and she was supposed to be retiring. But I had learned right before I went in that she had come out of retirement again to be a janitor level one again. So an entry level janitor. And I was confused, you know, and I thought something happened. And I said, Mary, why did you come out of retirement? I went off the interview script. And she said, Zach, I was at home. I couldn't stand the thought of those kids not having a mom figure away from home. And it wasn't what she did, but that the impact she made through what she did was such a powerful psychological force that it literally pulled her out of retirement.
Yeah.
To do a job that's often degraded by society again.
Yeah, it can't be fun.
Right. That's what we find when we look at the research on people in frontline work or craft-based professions, or really in most professions. It's being able to see the impact of what you're doing, even on if it's a teammate or someone next to you, and thinking about that impact can be really critical to building resilience. You know, Angela Duckworth, psychologist, in her book called Grit, she finds that a sense of purpose is one of the key predictors of perseverance over time.
That makes sense, though, especially when you connect it to how you're helping others and how they're, how they need you.
Well, let's think about it. Think about Mary, right? Who's the janitor. She's there to be a mom figure away from home for students who don't have their parents around. And then you have maybe John, who's just there to get a paycheck and get to the weekend.
Yeah.
And imagine them both facing the same stressful situation.
Right.
You have Mary, who's there to be an educator. You have John, who's just there to get the paycheck. The response to the stressor, what we find with people with purpose, is completely different and more productive and positive.
Yeah. And you can completely understand why. Like, I was so touched by her story. Now, when I first read her story, I was thinking about back in grad school, we said something about job crafting.
Yes.
Is that kind of similar?
It is. Yep. It's crafting the perceptions of the job.
Okay. Yeah.
That's what that mentality is.
Okay. Yeah. So go back to that for a minute. When you say that's a skill that can be built, any other tips you would have for someone, like how they go about building that skill?
Yeah. So let's start with job crafting, because it's really evidence-backed. It's practice tested. The research indicates that it can result in not only higher levels of meaningfulness, it can result in higher levels of overall positive self-image. And so Amy Wierzchowski, organizational psychologist at Yale, actually pioneered job crafting. And there's three ways to craft meaning into your work. One, you can change the perceptions of your task. So, and by thinking about the greater good that it has, for example, that perception of, I'm not just cleaning the toilet, I'm making sure kids don't get sick, is a way you can shift perceptions. You can also focus your perception. So say there's a part of your task that you like and other parts of it that you don't like, you can focus more of your time thinking about the parts of your job that you do like and that do bring you meaning. The other way is to craft your relationships. So instead, if you're a supervisor, instead of thinking, I have to manage this person, you can recraft your relationship by saying, I get to support this person. And that's very powerful, right? Because once you start reframing that and how can I best support this person versus how can I best manage this person, it can bring you more meaning, as a supervisor research finds. And then you can also change the tasks that you do. So for example, if there are tasks that bring you more meaning, doing them at the beginning of the day and at the end of the day. So when you do the tasks, you can
really,
you can shift how you experience it. Because what we know is that we tend to make meaning by how we start something and how we finish it. So if you finish your day doing all the things you don't like to do, your brain will start appraising your day as bad.
Yeah.
Right. Or as a grind. So you could end the day doing something that you love doing. And then also you could say you're in a job you don't like at all.
Yeah.
I am reminded of a story of a woman who loved stand-up comedy, and she would think about making jokes with her colleagues and how that would help her as a stand-up comic. So being able to link tasks that you do in work that aren't hard tasks and be able to think about how it helps you with something you love outside of work, those are all ways to build more meaning.
Wow. That's really cool.
I know that was a lot, but it's really powerful because it's evidence-based. I mean, that's been tested.
Yeah. And I never really thought about the how you start and how you finish. Because you're right. If you finish the day with a bunch of stuff you don't like doing, the sense of dread's like, oh, I got to do this again tomorrow. Even if 90% of the day was good.
And if you start your day too by saying like, oh man, I got to get to my inbox in the morning. I mean, imagine if the voice in your head was a motivational speaker. And then you can ask yourself why you're not motivated in the morning, right? It's just like me when I... 2 years ago, I'd get up every day and I realized I was looking at my calendar. You know, what's the first thing you do? You look at your phone, you say, what do I have to do today?
Yeah.
I mean, what a deflating question. But we ask ourselves these questions in our minds all the time. So instead of that, you know, what I started doing is I just started making a little note on my notebook that was, instead of what do I have to do today, just how is what I'm going to do today going to affect other people? If I was going into a meeting that I dreaded, I would write down people's names and any personal details I could remember about them.
Yeah.
So like it's all of a sudden I'm coming into a meeting with John, who is this and has two kids, instead of I have to get through this meeting.
Yeah.
Anytime we can rehumanize our day, it's a powerful way to bring meaning to our day.
That's a great point. One of the things, Zach, that I'm picking up now, and I picked it up in the book too, is sometimes when I talk to people, there's a perception that purpose is not only that it's something that's found or you know sent to us from the heavens above,
right,
but it's like this grand, like it's big and it's grand. And what I'm hearing is purposeful is in everyday moments, everyday life.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, you can get a lot of purpose anxiety, which is a real psychological thing.
Is it really?
Yeah. Like when someone goes and tells you to find your purpose, I mean, you can really, it can cause anxiety. You get overwhelmed. It's like when someone says, start eating better.
Yeah.
But they don't show you how to eat better, what to do today to eat better, right? You're more likely to not eat better. So that's why right. When someone reads a Find Your Purpose book or blog, it's really nice to say, oh, that's great. And then paralysis, right? It's like, what do I do? Or that's not for me.
Or what's wrong with me that I don't know?
Yeah. But purpose is an everyday experience. It can't be a one-time event, aha event, right? I mean, when you really talk to people who experience high levels of purpose, and what the research indicates is that it's a way of life, right? Mm. It's a way of thinking. It's a way of being. It's just like any type of mindset or way of being. And so, and that's why I say that creating purposeful lives and purposeful organizations are a skill, is a skill that we can learn. And that's pretty liberating.
Yeah.
Because then it means like, okay, like how can I do that? And that's where you get into the beyond the theoretical aspects of purpose into how it actually manifests. It's just like strengths. We know the research on strengths. Having strengths actually doesn't have any positive outcome. Using them does.
Yeah.
So when you can use your strengths, it has all those outcomes on well-being and motivation. But just knowing your strengths, putting a poster on the wall of your strengths, top five strengths, doesn't do anything. Same is true with stating a purpose. Doesn't do anything unless you're using purpose, aka contributing every day.
Yeah. No, that makes perfect sense. Okay. So with, and I know that like this is a huge question. So high level, how do people go about, when you say that you work with organizations, how do they create that purposeful environment?
Yeah. I think number one, you have to experience purpose yourself. You know, it really starts. It's going to come across as inauthentic if you haven't learned to discern meaningfulness where you are. So how do you do that, right? Being able to be focused on the greater good of your actions. So there's three components that make any task meaningful or work meaningful. One is called significance, right? We have to know how what we're doing benefits other people. So making sure you're focused on the beneficiaries of what you do, regardless of how small you think it is, it affects another human being usually.
That's right.
The second is called task identity. So being able to link how what you're doing will make a bigger product or a bigger whole possible. Like for example, when a researcher is working on a project and they can see what the end product might look like, the end model might look like while they're doing it, they've experienced more meaningfulness.
Wow. That makes sense.
Yeah. And then the third is to be curious about yourself. How do I use my strengths more to do this task? So significance, what does it make possible? And then strengths are three key attributes. So doing that for yourself, I think is important. Being able as a leader to state what you want your impact to be.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is this is where purpose statements are helpful. Not because it's your one grand purpose statement, but because when you can state how you want your strengths to impact other people, that's what a good purpose statement does. It becomes part of your environment. So that's the first piece I would tell a leader is you have to know how to experience it yourself and be centered on the impact of your work and also experience it yourself before you create it for other people.
Yeah. Because otherwise it just would not ring true.
Right. No. Yeah. I
mean, not even a little bit.
Yeah. But then if you want to do it for other people, so after you've done that, I mean, there's really three ways that I've seen work. And I sound like, oh, here's a three-step model, but it's really hard work, each of these. One is right, creating mattering. If you want people to experience purpose, if you want people to know their contribution, they first have to believe they have something to contribute.
Yeah.
If you want someone to use their strengths, they first have to believe they have strengths.
Yeah.
So making sure that you're adopting a leadership style that makes sure people are noticed, make sure you know people, you know personal attributes about them, you can name their strengths, you know who they are as a person is powerful. Making sure they're affirmed. So instead of just telling people good job, routinely showing them the difference that they make. and how they do it. And then creating cultures where people feel like they are needed, that they're indispensable to the bigger whole, that they're relied on. And that gets at the second piece, which is connecting people to purpose, making sure people know how their work enables a bigger aspiration, a bigger reason for being. And then the final piece is proving it through your practices. So making sure that when you look at everything that you do in an organization, whether it's recruitment, training, onboarding, evaluation, reward structures, that you're both developing people for meaningfulness and rewarding people for meaningfulness.
Okay.
Yeah. So just do that and you'll be fine.
It's so easy, right?
But yes, but that's a helpful framework just to think, am I creating mattering? Am I connecting people's work? Do people have a clear line of sight between what they do and how it impacts other people?
Yeah.
And then practices, do our practices reinforce that way of being?
Yeah, that's cool. And something you said there when you said the indispensable, I think, because I was trying to remember like why I first reached out, because I know I started seeing some of your posts on LinkedIn, and it was something that you had written about helping people feel indispensable. Because the flip side of that is you're just another number. You're just a cog in the system.
Yep.
Man, that just feels like demoralizing.
It does. Some people say to me, I've worked with manufacturers who say to me, Zach, well, our people are dispensable. I once had an HR department say I couldn't use the word indispensable in my work with them.
Really?
Because it might create the contractual obligation to somebody.
Oh, man.
And here's what I said. I said, skills are replaceable. Human beings are not.
Yeah.
And what the key is when I was working with these leaders of these line workers, as I said, it's a matter of finding something about that person that they bring to the job that you need.
Yeah.
And I remember it was like, there was this one line leader who was having difficulty with some line workers. And one of the line workers had not put in a full 2 weeks, had an absentee problem. And I asked the line leader, I said, what is something that you would miss about him if he was gone as a person, not as a worker? And he said, oh, well, he sings on the line when he's doing his work.
That's
he sings.
Cool.
I love that. So I said, the next time he's absent, say, I really missed your singing. And so the next time he was absent, he said that. And it opened up a relationship. And the guy had put in over a month without being absent, which is important for him because he doesn't get attendance points. He gets paid. He can put food on his table. But it was also an opening point, the line leader said, where I was just treating him as someone who was going to disappoint me versus treating him as someone who had something I needed.
Yeah.
And when we feel like we're relied on as humans, it's really powerful.
It's extremely powerful. You know, my little sister and I were talking about this because we grew up on a farm in Southwest Missouri. When I was 12, my parents moved down there. It was a self-sufficient farm. Tons of work. We woke up every morning in the summertime, Zach, and we had a sheet of paper, two columns for each of us, all the things we had to do. Cause it was a lot of work, but we've talked about it and we're like, I don't regret that work in the least because we mattered. Our contributions mattered to our family. That's how we had food in the wintertime.
Yep.
You know, and that to me is exactly what you're saying there. Well, I don't know if it's exactly, but that's what it reminds me of.
Very similar. Yeah. Like people have, like being able to see too, like listing it out, being able to see how you matter.
Yeah.
And to see, and one of the really powerful thought experiments you can do if you feel like you don't matter is to think about something you do on your everyday basis and then think about what would happen to a human being if you did not do it. Ooh. And what you quickly find is that you're inevitably linked to other people. And I often say also, if you are around other people, which everybody is at some virtually or not every day, making sure people know if it wasn't for you, just tell people if it wasn't for you and show them continually what they make possible. Because one of the most common statements when researchers look at journals of people who are indicating self-harm, one of the most common statements across all of these journals and writings is, nobody would miss me if I was gone.
Oh, man.
And that gets at that lack of feeling needed. So this is not only good for like work or ourselves or our families, but I think it's a public health need to make sure people feel noticed, affirmed, and needed.
Yeah. Especially now. It seems like it's worse now somehow.
I think so. I think there is a number of factors coalescing to create a gap, a meaning gap for people. I mean, you have a large portion of workers who the government's told was essential, all of a sudden, they're seeing their essentialness. And now they're going back into their workplaces asking, do I feel essential? Do my policies and pay make me feel essential? You have people who research is finding that people are increasingly reflecting on their jobs and their life more than ever. Like, is this how I want to spend my time?
Wow.
Based on the changes in work. You have job plus health insecurity, and you have rising calls for social justice. There is like, it's coming together for this moment of what is my role in this?
Yeah.
Who am I? Why am I? And I think one reason why I work with people in organizations is that the place where people spend 35% of their waking lives is one of the places people are going to be asking the answers to those questions.
I'm just thinking about, I can imagine that sometimes you would face resistance in terms of, you know, yeah, but I'm just doing X. What does it really matter?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's, I don't know. Oh, because one of the things you said in the book, there's a person at the end of everything that you do, whether it's if you're working at Starbucks, if you're manufacturing a widget, whatever it is, there's a person out there who benefits by what you're doing. And I think sometimes we don't see that connection.
Yeah. Viktor Frankl, who's a concentration camp survivor. He was also a psychiatrist. He wrote the book, Man's Search for Meaning, but he also recently, Daniel Goleman, who wrote on emotional intelligence, helped publish a unpublished series of lectures.
The book's
called Yes to Life. I highly recommend it.
Yes to Life.
And he talks more in this book about work. And one of the things that he was talking about was he was recounting a story of a tailor. There was this person who worked at a tailor shop for a tailor's assistant, tailoring clothes. And the guy came up to him after a lecture and said he was doing in Vienna. And he said, you know, this is all great, Viktor, but Dr. Frankl, but I'm just a tailor. And Viktor Frankl responded by, meaning comes from filling the circle that you're in, filling your usefulness for those around you. And what he said is that tailor, after asking him, have you thought about all the people you see? Have you been of most use to all of the people that have come into that shop? And the tailor, you know, said no. And Viktor Frankl replied, then you haven't tried to see the meaning that's already there.
Oh.
So I love that notion of filling the circle that you're in right now.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that you shouldn't have career development goals. Doesn't mean that you shouldn't have a future vision for yourself. But we also don't know if we have next week or the week after or the month after, right? We get so obsessed with what I've heard called destination addiction. The false belief that if we get there, then we'll be happy. If we get there through the weekend, then we'll be rested.
Yeah.
That creating the skill set to see meaning now is one way to disrupt that if-then obsession.
Because it's always a, I'll be happy when.
And you recently had a podcast on this, right? The false destination.
The false summits.
Yeah, false summits.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's a trap we fall into, right?
It is.
Yeah. And now the name of your book is The Invisible Leader. And I at first I'm like, what does that mean? And then when I start reading, I'm like, oh, yeah. I got it. But tell me about the name of the book and tell us a little bit about the book while we're talking about it, because we've referenced it a lot.
Yeah. So the name comes through who I think is the most influential management thinker at the time. But unfortunately, she was a woman in 1928. And so a lot of her thoughts have been unfortunately subjugated in history. But she's amazing. Her name is Mary Parker Follett. And she was prophetic, and she talked about leadership not as being about a person. So this is like influencing our lives, influencing organizations. And she said, leaders and followers are both following the invisible leader, the common purpose, that the invisible threads that bound people together, you and I on this podcast right now having this conversation, is some invisible leader that's making this happen. It's a common purpose that we have. The same is true in organizations. The most powerful leader is not a person, it's a purpose. The same is true in life, right? Your purpose, the contribution you want to make. When you look at people who have been through so much, when you look at people who sacrifice themselves for, whether it's for the country through military service, or you look through missionary service, or you look at volunteership service, those people subjugate themselves to the bigger purpose, the invisible leader.
And the book
is really about how to create that sense of purpose as the invisible leader of life, of organizations, as ironically the most powerful leadership tool.
Yeah. Yeah. And I highly recommend it. It was great. And I loved how much you talked about helping people feel significant, helping people feel like they matter.
Yeah.
You know,
because you talked about the false summits, like why do we rely on the summit so much?
And yeah.
It's because we desperately want some signal that we matter. We want some reward we can put on our resume, something we can post about on LinkedIn that
yeah.
says you did it.
Yeah.
And what really what it's about is mattering.
Yeah. Will someone remember me?
Yeah.
Will someone notice me?
I want a signal, right?
Yeah.
I want that salary.
Give me a signal.
I want that salary number because it's evidence that I matter.
Yeah.
But true mattering comes from what we talked about, the belief
yeah.
that you are significant. And that belief that you are significant, that transcends whatever you achieve or don't achieve, is a community effort because we have to rely on others to show us the evidence of our significance.
That's interesting. Why is that?
Well, because like you can believe that you matter,
yeah.
but then in the absence of being in a community that regularly shows you that you matter,
uh-huh.
your environment ultimately can recreate new beliefs. So,
yeah.
you know, for example, if like when we look at emotions, right? I just was having this conversation. Emotion is something that's triggered by some sort of environmental stimuli, but it's not the environmental stimuli, it's your experiences with that environmental stimuli that creates the
yeah.
emotion. For example, I might show a picture of a baby. And if I like babies because I've had a good experience with a baby and I believe babies are good, when I see that picture of a baby, I'm going to say, smile. Oh, baby.
It's a baby.
But say if you had a negative experience with babies,
yeah.
maybe you think like babies are messy, or, you know, and like, and your
they're
belief
loud
is,
and
yeah, your belief is, I don't want a baby or I don't like babies. You see a picture of a baby, you're going to have the opposite reaction, but it all goes back to that belief. This is not about babies, by the way. This is about
That's
the belief.
Right.
like the belief of babies are good or babies are not good. And that is, we have those beliefs about ourselves. And
yeah.
it determines our responses to everything. It determines our emotions. And so, but those beliefs are created through experiences in our environment.
Yeah.
Same is true with matter. If we experience that we matter and we can say we believe that we matter. If we experience that we don't matter, you can say it a lot. You can do a lot of self stuff, but it's short-lived.
Yeah. Okay. So that makes me think about during the pandemic, when people are working from home, they're working remotely, they're not there. They don't get that kind of stuff over the, you know, near at the water cooler, the, you know, coffee pot, whatever that is, you know, is, I would imagine it's harder to get that kind of feedback that you matter.
It's harder, especially when leaders are pushing these encounters to be faster.
Yeah.
Because they think people don't want to be on video calls. So here's the unintended side effect, right?
Yeah.
I've been observing different meetings where people get on and they're like, the leader will say, oh man, aren't you all just sick of doing this on Zoom? Can you imagine? That's how they start a meeting. Can you imagine going into a meeting and in person and be like, man, this really sucks that we have to do this in a conference room right now. All right. So let's go. Right.
Yeah,
or
let's make this
say,
fast.
Let's get through the agenda as quick as possible. So we can all, we don't want to be on video calls all day. So
yeah.
what you do is you think you're doing something healthy, which you are. I mean, limiting video calls, great. But I would say what's more important is optimizing spaces for people to be with one another in video calls
yeah.
and do all the doing stuff in emails.
Yeah. Because it's that connection.
Give the updates in the emails. Like use
yeah,
the
yeah.
meetings for learning ways of being
yeah.
together.
Man, that's a yeah. great idea. You know, and I'm thinking
Thanks.
About like, being an entrepreneur, like a lot of times you're kind of in your isolation booth.
I know.
You know, it's like,
I get it.
Does
I'm
anybody
right there
get
with
it? You. Yeah. Is it anybody here? You know, does it
yeah.
matter to anyone? Oh, that's great. And I know I want to be respectful of your time. How can people find out more about your work, how to connect with you, that type of thing?
Yeah. I've kind of gone a little dark lately, but because I'm working on another book and then some
Ooh.
Research projects.
But right.
I have really enjoyed LinkedIn. So
okay.
if you could follow me there, it's Zach Mercurio. I didn't realize there was such a group of people on LinkedIn like that we connected that really
yep.
care deeply about doing this
oh.
work.
Yeah.
So it's, and it's really cool. And people want to learn from it. And so I love the dialogue that gets sparked there.
Yeah.
So if you can, I will respond to you. And it's me. I don't have a social media person. I've really found a lot of meaning in LinkedIn, believe it
yeah.
or not. So Zach Mercurio, you can find me there. And then I'm going to be restarting a monthly newsletter that I was doing
Ooh.
Called The Spark. I took a little break from it. Breaks are good. And it's at zachmercurio.com. And
Perfect.
I write about different practices for building more meaningfulness into life and work.
Nice.
And perfect. I try the practices myself.
So you're not just talking about them. No. You're actually using them.
Yeah.
That's perfect. I'll put all those in the show notes. Okay. One final question. You had a post on LinkedIn. It was recently about, oh, it was about organizations. And if you're trying to have a well-being.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Because it was like, when I read that, I'm like, oh, that is so spot on. I mean, just, you know, high level about that one. Because I thought that was great.
I may have to come back sometimes to talk about this.
That's perfect.
I had this realization, and I don't know when it was. I think that someone had asked me to come and do a purpose, discover your purpose kind of workshop for a company because people were burnt out and they needed to reconnect to purpose. And I realized that all I would be teaching them is how to cope with an environment that's stressing them out.
Yeah.
And what I had this realization of is I was like, this whole employee wellness industry is really an employee coping industry. What we're doing is that we're giving people tools to cope with an environment that's draining people.
Yeah.
So when it comes to burnout, the mission that I'm on now, since that like big realization, and I may have been complicit in it in my own work, is that we need to make sure environments don't drain people.
Yeah.
Not focus on giving people time to recharge.
Recharging
and vacations, great. That should happen just because humans are people. But we should focus on creating environments where people have flexibility, they have compassionate leadership, they are able to have some sort of say in their schedules, and they're able to just be a autonomous human being.
Right.
That's free. So the environment must not drain the energy you're seeking to recharge through giving them more vacation.
Yeah. Well, and it goes back to what you said near the beginning of this, not just living for 2/7 of your life.
Yeah.
You know? So when I read that, I'm like, oh my gosh, that was just sitting right between the eyes. It's like, that is so true.
And it hit me what between are we doing? The eyes. I was like, gosh, all of these things that I think are good, like, right? Like whether it's mindfulness or whether it's purpose or finding meaningfulness, there's something that's been missing over the past 10 years of this employee wellness stuff, which is the fact that the environment is also unwell.
Yeah.
And you put a well individual into an unwell environment, they will become an unwell individual.
Yeah. Yeah. And how do we change that?
Yeah.
You know, I loved it when I read that. So,
yeah.
Well, Zach, thank you so much. This has been absolutely great. Yeah. I love it. I love your enthusiasm around it. It's infectious. Yeah. Just thanks for being on the show and sharing your wisdom.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
You bet. I loved talking with Zach, and just being around his passion for the work that he is doing is absolutely inspiring. So here are my three insights for thriving. Number one, the ultimate security is developing self-worth. For whatever reason, that was powerful. It really hit me. And I just loved that piece of the story. Number two, purpose is not something out there waiting to be found. It is something waiting to be acknowledged. I loved how Zach talked about it being purposeful. Purpose isn't something that we craft into a cool statement and then we hang it on the wall. It is something that we live every day. And something that showed up for me, number three, something that showed up for me in a number of ways in the interview was the message of connecting to how what we do is making a difference for someone else. I loved the story that he shared about Brittany, who said, "Who needs me right now? Who needs me to get through this?" I didn't share this during the interview, but that triggered a memory for me from back in 2003 when I got sick. It was about a month into my illness. We'd been to the doctor, and it was right after I collapsed on the floor of my doctor's office. And I mean, I nearly died. It was a very, very close call. And the following week after the collapse, I got an email from an entrepreneur who had attended my workshop, and she had been to several of my speaking engagements. And the email said, "You have to get better. There are people who need your message and who need your help. You have to get better." That email made a difference for me. It was a source of inspiration, and it was a source of fuel. So thank you, Naomi, for sending it. Those are my three insights for thriving from this episode. It was hard to narrow it down. If you have ever found any value in listening to this podcast, and if you'd like to help us grow, please do us a big favor. If you could go to Apple and leave us a review and a rating, that would be awesome. This one action helps us tremendously, as it's how Apple decides which shows to recommend, and then that allows us to reach more people and to help them thrive as well. So today, I will leave you with these two questions. One, who is out there depending on you to deliver your gifts and your strengths? And two, what is the difference that will make in their lives?